is.
Donald on a Kitchen Talks about food. Kitchen Talks recipes. Donald on a Kitchen Talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donald on a Kitchen. I'm Lana Noctigal.
And I am Donna Prisgintas.
The Donald on a Kitchen has been on the air for almost a whole year. We've been talking to you here from the kitchen at the KHOI Studios, and we have had a good time all year and looking forward to another year of fun and frolic. Hope you've all had a good Christmas celebration, and we still have more celebrating to do. Last week, we started to explore the feasts and traditions of the 12 days of Christmas, and right in the middle of it, here comes the new year. A great New Year's tradition is enjoying bubbly.
So we wanted to encourage that enjoyment. So today we're going to talk about the kinds of bubbly besides just champagne and what the differences are. And for this discussion, we have my good drinking buddy, Ann Kinzel, who's my neighbor, who happens to have a French mother and grew up a good bit in France and has some amusing champagne stories to tell us. So welcome, Ann.
Hey, welcome. Nothing better than talking about some mousseur, some champagne, some bubbly, whatever we want to call it.
Well, one of the reasons I wanted to talk about it was because, as we all know, champagne can be quite expensive. And so, for parties on New Year's, sometimes we don't get enough bubbly. So I was going to encourage other people to try other kinds of bubbly that are quite a bit less expensive. And we were going to talk about the differences and what some of them are with, say, cava or prosecco. But first, let's start with Anne, and she's going to tell us about what method champenoise means.
Sure. Well,
and why it explains why champagne is so expensive.
Oh, yeah. So champagne is sort of the top of the line of the bubbly drinks. And I think there's two reasons for that. One, it comes from a limited region of France called Champagne, about 90 miles north of Paris. And for a wine to be called Champagne, the grapes have to be grown there. So that limits your territory.
Called AOC?
Yes.
Let's see. What's that stand for?
Appellation Originale Contrôlée.
Means the name of the origin is controlled.
Yes. So it has to come from that region. And then the second reason that champagne is expensive is because it's very labor intensive. Champagne has to be stored and it has
in
to
the
be
bottle.
In the bottle. It has to be babied. You put grape juice in the bottle, if you will, and you add sugars and yeast, and you have to store that and turn it on a schedule by hand.
So per
bottle. So don't be surprised if that bottle's pretty pricey. It represents all that good labor.
And you were explaining to me about why you turn it, how you turn it, and what happens with the yeast. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. Now, I'm no vintner, but I kind of grew up with this, and I've been down in some champagne caves and seen what happens. So they put the grape juice in the bottle, and they add some yeast and sugar, and then they go in, and they turn it. And each time it turns, it helps the yeast and
the
sugar.
Wait, so the bottle is laid on its side, right?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
In these kind of A-frame sort of racks.
I've seen them. They're interesting looking.
Yes. Very ancient looking. So it's down in these limestone caves and it's all these racks. It's really impressive. And they turn them like a quarter turn. And as they do that, the sugar and the yeast rise to the top. And then when they get all the way up there, they have to take it out.
Oh, the top of the bottle. So they're laid kind of on their side, but with the top pointing up. So how do you get the yeast out of the bottle without losing the bubbles?
Well, there's two ways. What they do is they pop the temporary cork, okay? And at that point, sometimes in the cheaper wines, the less expensive champagnes, they actually kind of freeze the bottle. And then so they can just sort of plop out that yeast and sugar little mass. And the more expensive stuff, they actually pop the cork and it shoots out. I've not seen it done, but it sounds really cool.
Well, the shooting part we can imagine because that's what it does. So then they put in that big mushroom cork after they've taken the yeast out.
Yes. And then I think they let it rest a little bit longer.
And the wire and all the stuff that you have to take off of it is to keep it from
blowing up.
Before you want it to.
Or as the French say, that premature explosion of champagne. Yeah.
And what is the significance of the limestone caves? Temperature? Well,
probably temperature. It's very constant. And the region of Champagne is full of these limestone caves.
Naturally occurring.
Then. Absolutely.
Huh. So describe your experience of going there with your grandfather as a little girl.
Sure. My grandfather sold industrial things, and among them were like tracks for mini railroads. Mm-hmm. And he sold these little mini tracks to these champagne, what they call houses in France. And so one day we got invited for a tour, and we got to go down in these limestone caves. They were enormous. You actually rode a little train to get around.
Oh, and that's where they had the tracks.
Yes. And the bottles, saw guys turning bottles. They all had, you know, like little labels on them saying when this lot had to be turned. And It was really impressive, and it was huge. I think it was Domaine Chandon. And it was quite the operation.
Well, that's a fun thing for a little girl to do with her grandfather.
Even got to taste a little champagne.
Of course. I my son's father is French, and when his brother came over when our son was born, the first thing they did was, you know, of course, crack a bottle, and they put it on the baby's tongue.
Oh, it seems much nicer than a cigar. I like that. I like that. So we can see why champagne is well loved, well tended, and it should be expensive. Lots of care goes into it.
Right. So if you're like me and you love the bubblies, and you know, like every once in a while there'll be some champagne in my life, but most of the time, like for example, if you're having a party and you don't want to buy, you know, 15 bottles of champagne, we've been exploring in Ames a lot of other bubbly alternatives. And what are some of your favorites?
Well, I really like Prosecco from Italy.
Me too.
And I like the Cavas from Spain.
Mm-hmm. And these are both bubbly and white. And you can readily find them anywhere from $10 to $20 as opposed to at least $50 to $100 for champagne.
Hmm.
So this makes it at least reasonable party material.
Sure. I think some of the Spanish ones can even drop a little bit lower than that, depending on the euro. But there's also a French, what we call crémant or mousseux.
Spell crémant.
C-R-E-M-A-N-T, which is how you can sell bubbly or sparkly wine in France where the grapes are not grown in Champagne.
Ah, I haven't seen any of that in Ames. Do you know any place you can get it?
I don't know in Ames, though there are liquor stores in Ames where you can certainly make special orders.
Mm-hmm.
I suspect that a lot of the French crémant is probably sold in Europe and in France and not so much
exported
in the export markets.
Uh-huh. Well, we do know for sure that you can buy cava and Prosecco all over town. Really, the Hy-Vees both have it. Wheatsfield has it. Cyclone Liquor has it. And there are multiple price ranges for it. And they're really quite yummy. They're not sweet.
No, I think that the cava is maybe...
Now, the cava is Spanish.
Yes. Is a little lighter, in a sense, than the Prosecco.
I think usually it's quite bubbly.
Yeah.
Sometimes the Prosecco, although it's bubbly, it seems to have smaller bubbles, maybe.
Yeah, I guess I'd say the Prosecco is a little calmer. You can be a little bit more careful popping that cork. You're probably not going to get a missile going through the kitchen.
Oh, but that's the fun of it sometimes. Everybody screams.
Yeah.
There's something very celebratory about opening a bottle of bubbly.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that so many people do it this time of year and probably never again throughout the whole year, or maybe perhaps for a wedding. It is definitely a cause to celebrate. Celebrate,
well, you
celebrate.
Know, people are now, I think, drinking more and more Proseccos in the summertime because it is light and kind of a fun summer drink. I I'll drink a Prosecco anytime.
Yeah, I think we're seeing people drink more lightly bubbled wines mm-hmm. in the summer. So there's the Prosecco. There's also...
Which is Italian.
Which is Italian, yeah. There's also a wine from Portugal, which is very inexpensive, which is not really a bubbly, but it has just kind of a hint of bubbles called Vinho Verde, or green wine.
That's true. And also I've seen some from South America as well, some Vinho Verde. And also one thing that's become more and more popular are champagne or bubbly cocktails.
Yes.
Oh, wait, that with your eyebrows going up, it sounds like you speak from experience.
Sure. Yeah, I think that champagne lends itself to wonderful cocktails. I mean, if you think about it, it's sort of like a soda with taste. Huh?
Yeah, and I think the most famous one would be probably mimosas, which are, what is that with, is it orange juice? Is that what's a mimosa? Orange, yeah. Fresh orange juice and champagne or bubbly of any kind. Works yeah. well with the cava or Prosecco.
Well, I was just reading for this New Year's a whole in the magazine Food and Wine. They had a whole section on champagne cocktails or bubbly wine cocktails. I think if you're going to make a cocktail out of bubbly wine, don't go buy a $60 bottle of champagne.
No, it's kind of a waste.
But you can make some wonderful cocktails with other spirits or liquors that really bring out the taste of the champagne and maybe lighten up mm-hmm. the flavor profile of the cocktail a little
well,
bit.
Well, now let's see. We had one last night, and it was lemon juice, maraschino liquor, which is, it has a cherry in it, but maraschino liquor is, I think, from Croatia, and it is cherry flavored, but not the kind of cherry that we're thinking about. It's a little...
Less sweet.
Oh, certainly. It's not sweet at all. And it's not red at all. It's actually clear. And then what else did we put in that?
There was some lemon juice.
Oh, and white Lillet, which is a French aperitif wine. And then the bubbly on top of it.
Yeah. It makes a delicious sort of lightly fruity. It's almost a bit warm, even though it's a cool drink. It had
it's a New
really
Year's
nice,
Eve cocktail.
Yeah, it was
it's
great.
A cocktail.
It's great.
And then champagne or any of the bubblies mix really well with almost any kind of fruit juice or like a Kir Royale. Isn't that? That's a classic one also. It's champagne or bubbly with, what's the blackcurrant liqueur?
Cassis.
Creme de cassis, which is just slightly sweet. All kinds of possibilities there for fun mix-em-ups, good ways to celebrate. And do try some of these other bubblies. It's not like the – well, and they're California ones too.
Yeah, they're California. A lot of the French champagne houses bought land in California in the 70s and 80s and produced their own version of champagne there or bubbly. They're typically sort of in between – the French champagnes, price-wise, and the Spanish cavas and mm-hmm. Italian proseccos.
Mm-hmm. And there's even a good, I guess you can't call it a champagne, but it's a Gruet, which is from New Mexico.
Yes, I've had that here in Ames.
They're quite good.
Yeah, I have to admit, I was a little skeptical at first. You know, I've been to New Mexico. It didn't look like champagne country to me at all. Big sky, dry. But the Gruet is a really, really nice champagne. They have a rosé, I think. They have a dry one, and they have a semi-sweet.
They have a blanc de blanc, too.
Yeah.
Tell us what a blanc de blanc is.
Well, blanc de blanc means, in French, sort of white of whites. And it's a champagne that's made with only white grapes and only Chardonnay, generally. And oddly enough, you can make white champagne with red grapes.
And why isn't it pink then?
Well, I think it has to do with when they take out the skins.
Oh, so they don't use the skins.
Yes, and champagne is always a blended wine.
Mm-hmm.
So they're blending different grapes, the sugar, the yeast, and they're always trying to get what they call the perfect balance. The art of the vintner is the perfect balance in the champagne.
And you want to explain the different names for Brut, Extra Dry, Demi-Sec, the whole thing?
Well, extra dry is exactly what it says. Brut is kind of in between, and demi-sec, I think, is the sweetest, isn't it?
Right, but isn't Brut the most dry?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so.
Ah,
I have to admit, that's something where I sort of like them all, so I don't really think about it. The only thing I don't like, to be honest, is I don't like the very sweet Asti Italian bubblies. That's just a little too sweet for me. But that's at the real extreme end of the scale.
Yeah, those are kind of like bubbly alcoholic soda pops, actually. And they're fun for some things.
Oh, and maybe for mimosas, who knows?
Yeah, they're very sweet. So depends on how sweet your sweet tooth is, I guess.
Well, everybody celebrates with a bubbly their own way, and it's nice if there's so many different tastes out there.
Oh, yes, and do explore. And we actually have quite a lot of varieties being sold around town, so you can try the different ones. In fact, I like to have a taste test, you know, where I'll get, say, a similar priced, like we were looking for, okay, what wine do we want for the party this year? So we picked some Proseccos and a couple of Cavas, all in this sort of $10 to $12 range, and kind of pre-tasted them. it's a lot of wine, because then if you buy a case, you get the case discount. But, you know, you don't want to buy a whole case of something you haven't tasted. So we have a lot of options in town. Just run out there tonight and buy a few, and then get the real one for tomorrow.
Gather your friends and family and prepare to raise a glass.
Bring in the new year.
But don't stop yourself then. Bubbly's good all year round, folks.
Thanks, Anne. Yes. Yes. Excellent advice to live by. Yes, sirree. Another wonderful way to celebrate the new year is with black-eyed peas and ham. And if you're going to be cooking up a batch of black-eyed peas and ham.
But that's for the morning after.
That's
the recovery from the champagne.
But that's it. You might want to think about getting this in your kitchen.
Have it made in advance.
Black-eyed peas and ham, Hoppin' John, is a good thing. It's been a nice thing to have on New Year's morning after that wonderful evening of New Year's Eve. Black-eyed peas and ham is a traditional thing for luck. I've heard it's because the little black-eyed peas, or the peas in general, are supposed to sort of remind one of multiple handfuls of coins, perhaps.
You mean it's not just a hangover cure?
Well, that too. But it's a good thing.
It's for prosperity. You're supposed to eat that on the New Year's Day for prosperity.
Right. Think of how rich we are. Yes, black-eyed peas and ham. A thing that goes with black-eyed peas and ham is cornbread. And there's lots of different recipes for cornbread, and here's one of them. So, tell us what you know about cornbread, Paul.
Well, simple is best, I've found, and what that means is not cheap ingredients, but good quality stuff. Stone ground cornmeal, I use typically Hodgson's Mill. Or if I can find something more local, I will use that. Bacon fat, butter, real eggs, good buttermilk, the whole nine yards. It really does make a difference. And one of the most necessary things is a well-seasoned cast iron skillet. Almost can't do good cornbread without a cast iron skillet.
Oh, one of those big black heavy jobs.
That's right.
Good. Yeah, cornbread is something that I came to actually after I moved to Iowa. I grew up in Wisconsin, and their cornmeal was something that you sort of saved to dredge your panfish in, perhaps. But cornbread is something I've really got a taste for, so that's good. The cornmeal, too, can make a big difference. Cornmeal that's sitting around in a cupboard can be kind of very, very tasteless. But like you said, a good quality, fresh ground cornmeal really helps to make the cornmeal.
Certainly does. And I'll just give you a quick recipe. Let's see. I found something printed many, many years ago that I have modified and used over the years that has worked very well for me. And let's say you have a 12-inch cast iron skillet. Then it would go, the ingredient list would go something like this. 4 cups of cornmeal. And again, good quality cornmeal. You don't want to stint on this stuff. 2 teaspoons full of salt. 3 very good free-range eggs. 3 cups of buttermilk, approximately. And I'll get into that a little bit later. 1.5 teaspoons of baking soda. And I'm going to say you should have 4 tablespoons of good melted bacon fat ready. And the way you work it is this. You dissolve the soda in the buttermilk. Now, when you do that, leave a little bit of space in the container you used for the buttermilk, because it will tend to bubble up and froth up a little bit.
Vesuvius size.
Mix the cornmeal and the salt and the egg and the buttermilk. The recipe that I've used for years says simply add hot melted bacon fat, pour into greased iron skillet, and bake at 375 until done. Well, there are some notes to that. One is preheat the oven. And prepare the skillet. And this is the way you do that. The recipe that I've used above, let's say, calls for 4 tablespoons of bacon fat. You put that in the skillet and heat it up on the top of the stove while you're mixing the very devil out of the other stuff. Now, when that fat is almost smoking, and it might be smoking a little bit.
This sounds dangerous, Paul.
No, it's not, really. But be careful. It's hot. Pour it into the batter while you're still mixing the batter, and then fill the skillet. Now, that skillet at this point should be hot enough that when you pour this batter in, it will sizzle. Pop it straight into the oven and bake it 375 until it cracks and browns on top and then pulls away from the skillet a little bit on the side. I predict you'll love it.
That was Paul Nelson, chief engineer here at KHOI, who's also pretty handy around the kitchen, and he shared with me his cornbread recipe that goes with New Year's black-eyed peas and ham. What about cornbread? Cornbread can be made lots of different ways. Do you have any words of wisdom, Donna?
Well, I would just make a few comments on, because I do a lot of very similar things to Paul. One thing that he didn't say is the reason for preheating the pan is that that's what gives the crustiness to this particular recipe. So I actually, if I don't have bacon fat, which is always the best, he's right, but if I don't have any, I'll use butter. And I actually put it in the oven instead of on the stovetop. So I'm heating the oven, and I put some oil in the pan, and I pour the batter right into the very hot oil in the pan, and that gets you a good sizzle and a nice crusty seal around the bottom of it. I just use the Joy of Cooking skillet cornbread recipe. So that's what it's called, skillet cornbread. Buttermilk is a great idea for the liquid. The other thing that I add to the Joy of Cooking recipe, I always put in about a tablespoon of crushed dried marjoram. I love marjoram. And then I add, sometimes I even add a little coriander powder, and I also put in some black pepper. And the thing about the corn, there's such a wide variation. Sometimes the store-bought stored corn is a little bit bitter. And so if you think your corn is a tiny bit bitter, I will put a little sugar in it. But if you're getting like our fresh Of course, we have plenty of corn here in Iowa. So we do have a lot of good cornmeal around mm-hmm. that's very fresh, like the early morning harvest mm-hmm. cornmeal mm-hmm. that we've talked about before. We've talked about their polenta. They're from Panora, Iowa. So they also have a cornmeal that's great for baking. If you really want to gild the lily, you can put in some ground cheese, which is really yummy.
Yeah, cornmeal offers itself up to a lot of additions. I tend mm-hmm. to add sugar depending on what I'm going to – if it's a breakfasty sort of cornmeal, make it a little sweeter. Mm-hmm, if it's mm-hmm. going to go with chili or beans later, maybe even put in a little bit of pepper. Who knows? Cornmeal, a good thing, and it's a good way to start out your new year.
And it's – you know, we forget not – it really is so easy to make, and it doesn't take any time at all. And fresh out of the oven, it is delicious. So if you're making your Hoppin' John, I would make that the night before
right. And
then just make that cornbread fresh in the morning and pop it out, and there you go.
You're ready.
Good start for the new year.
Good start for the new year. I want to mention here that next week, January 6th, Wheatsfield is having a cooking class given by Beth Kemp, and the topic, believe it or not, is hearty cornmeal. She's going to be cooking cornmeal many ways. So contact Wheatsfield for information on that class. We'll be listening to some celebratory music here. Here's a nice polka. Kitchen. If you're not up and dancing around your kitchen with that one, I don't know what it is. So, that was music by a band called Polkestra, and it's from their CD called Apocalypse Now, celebrating the polka. And this is what happens. This is what happens when you get a Canadian folk fiddler, a contrabassoonist from the Met in New York City, an Israeli accordionist and percussionist, a French horn player that runs a record store, and an internationally renowned violin soloist. If you get them together in New Jersey, they look at one another and say, let's play polkas.
I think they've been drinking some champagne. It's bubbly music.
It's so wonderfully silly. It's wonderful. they celebrate all sorts of things here with polkas. Yes. And we'll be listening a little bit to their music a little bit later. I want to remind you that you are listening to KHOI. 89.1 FM. We are community radio here in the heart of Iowa. Support this station. We roll along on your donations, your goodwill, and your energy. You can come in and also be part of this. This is community radio. Come and volunteer. Come and help us out. You can visit Donna Lana Kitchen on the KHOI website. That's khoifm.org. And on that KHOI website, you can go to talk programs. You can find Donna Lana Kitchen. And we have our own website there currently featuring Donna Lana Kitchen videos done by Helen Gunderson. She made some videos of us doing things. And you can have a link there, too.
Oh, right. That's where we talk about the corn.
Yes.
From Panora, Iowa, early morning harvest.
Right. There's a video talking about corn, and there's also a video, Donna in the kitchen with polenta. So
there's
two of those things there. If polenta.
Now, and polenta is just more coarsely ground than cornmeal that you would make cornbread out of. So same corn, different grind.
So learn how. We are a multimedia organization here. We talked about days of Christmas last time, and we're continuing through the days of Christmas because Christmas is not just Christmas. It's all the
it's 12 days
in between.
Plus Christmas Day, which was day zero. So that's 13 days of Christmas. This is a very long holiday, and we are not even halfway through it. Imagine that. So today, I will remind you, is the fifth day of Christmas, which is for the bringing in of the boar. B-O-A-R. Pig. Anyway. And this, it says, this is something very reminiscent of an ancient sacrificial event. That's today. Something wild is brought into the house.
So have a ham salad or something. celebrate the pig.
Okay. So tomorrow is New Year's Eve. We all know that. And Lana, how do you pronounce this one?
Hogamani. Well, that's how a Midwestern person would pronounce that. I think it's Celtic. Hogamani.
So apparently the main thing tomorrow, which you could understand if you were having a New Year's party, is this is where the house receives a mini spring cleaning. So it says all the slops and ashes are usually removed in the morning.
Get rid of them slops and ashes.
Debts must be paid, borrowed articles returned, stockings darned, tears mended, clocks wound up, musical instruments tuned, pictures hung straight. Now that I have trouble with that. Brass and silver must be glittering, fresh linens must be put on the beds. Even in the slummiest houses, brooms and pails and soap and polishing rags and darting needles emerge from neglected cupboards and drawers. And the bairns receive a thorough scrubbing in honor of the new year.
The little ones.
Ah, so I guess it's house cleaning day today.
It's house
to get ready
cleaning.
For the
party. Yes.
No, that's tomorrow. Sorry, tomorrow.
Right,
okay.
Tomorrow. Yeah, that's a good thing. We're out with the old, in with the new. The December 31st, New Year's Eve, Hogamani, commemorates the solar divinity Hogmagog. Isn't that a great name?
Hogmagog.
Yes.
Oh, that's new in my vocabulary. Hogmagog.
Yeah. Traditional festivities include dressing in hides and horns and guising, which means going around in processions with burning, smoking sticks to, again, clean out the old. Clean out the old. Clean in the new. Okay, here's a sort of a Scottish sort of poem that goes with that. Get up, good wife, and shake your feathers, and dinna think that we are beggars, for we are bairns. Children, come out to play. Get up and give us our Hogamani. There you go. So again, let's celebrate. So and clean
and be sure to pay
things.
All your debts today.
Oh, all right, right. I better get out the old checkbook and see.
Well,
what
you know,
do
it
again.
Is the end of the year, okay. And everything will just flip over. You know, you got to put away all the receipts and save it for your taxes and start the new pile again. You know.
Yeah.
Some things are still with us, always death and taxes, right?
Oh, there we go.
There's nothing ancient about that. So then tomorrow, New Year's Day is day 7, and that is New Year's Day, which we all quite understand quite well. There's nothing forgotten about that. And the old year is officially dead and laid to rest, and the new year begins in a mood of hopefulness. All right. That also is the tradition of wassailing, where they go out into the cider orchards and you kind of sing to the trees, means good health to us in the trees, I would suppose.
A good thought for apple trees right now. Good idea.
Yeah, so the wassail ceremony is a good thing to have. You heat a large container of beer or ale, and you add sugar and spice.
Hot beer? Blah.
Well, I don't know.
We'll try anything once.
Well, okay.
All right. So that's something I'll try, and I'll let you know how it is. It's you mix it with fruit juice.
Okay.
So that's New Year's Day after you've had your Hoppin' John in the morning. Day 8, which would be the 2nd, is somehow called Snow Day, when the icicles hang by the wall, and Dick the Shepherd blows his nail, and Tom brings logs into the hall, and milk comes frozen home in the pail. That's Shakespeare, okay? So the temperature's going down. We may even get some snow by then. So the 9th day is called Evergreen Day, which is sing lustily of Christmas folly, sing of ivy, bay, and holly, banish each its melancholy, and evermore be merry. Oh, this is a sweet little story. Why there are evergreens. When the great mystery was creating all the trees and plants, he wanted to give a gift to each of them. But he could not decide which gift was appropriate to which tree, and so he held a contest to find out. He told the young trees that he wanted them all to keep watch over the earth for 7 days and 7 nights. The trees were very excited to be given such an important task, and for the first night, they had no difficulty staying awake, but the second night it was harder, and some of them fell asleep. By the 3rd night, even more were unable to remain awake, even though they whispered to themselves for hours. On the 4th night, even more fell asleep. Finally, by the 7th night, only a handful were still awake. The pine, the cedar, the spruce, the fir, the holly, and the laurel. What in great endurance you all have, cried the great mystery. To you I shall give the gift of remaining green forever, and you shall guard the forest even in the dead of winter when all your brothers and sisters are sleeping. Ever since then, the rest of the trees lose their leaves in winter and sleep until the spring, but the evergreen trees are always awake and always watching.
How nice. You were going to talk about your plum pudding recipe.
Okay. We did put it up on the website. So this is from my grandmother, Mary Albright Baumgartner, and it is a steamed plum pudding.
Yeah, I looked through the recipe and I couldn't quite figure it out. But now, yeah, please.
So this is probably a Bavarian traditional, but I know the English plum puddings are the same. And I've seen containers for baking plum puddings where it has the pan, the molded pan, and then you has a lid that you clap on it, and then you put it into a larger pan, which has the water in it, and put another lid on that, and then you steam it. So since I don't really have one of those pans, I've used an angel food pan that I just cover with tin foil, or this year I actually used a bundt pan, which unmolded very, very nicely.
Oh, do you grease this pan before you put the stuff in?
I actually have one that's, you know.
Teflon-y?
Yeah. I don't think it's, I don't know what it is.
Well, but the unsticky. The unsticky kind,
yeah. Right. Plus, it has a lot of beef suet in it, which
is itself.
Now, I don't use beef suet very often, but for this one, it's really the appropriate thing. It gives the right flavor. Plus, beef suet, unlike pork or butter or any other oil, it's kind of crumbly in its texture naturally.
Okay.
So I do run it in the Cuisinart to make it even finer because you want to chop it really small because you mix that in unmelted with the flour and the fruits. A lot of dried fruits, 3 cups of dried fruits, and then a couple of egg yolks and some milk, and then, of course, a lot of spices, cinnamon, nutmeg, allspice, a little clove I think I used, and not a terribly sweet. This one had molasses in it because that was kind of what my grandmother used a lot. She was famous for her ginger molasses cookies, too. So you mix it all together in a fairly rough dough, and then you put it into this pan within the pan, and you put the water up to the sides of the pan. You don't want it to go over the top, of course, because you'll just get a gooey mess. And then you cook it a long time, maybe 3 or 4 hours, just steaming away.
And then on a very low heat.
Yeah. And I put a small like half an inch high rack in the bottom that I set it on so that the water is actually circulating on all across the bottom. And then
You wouldn't want the pan within the pan to be
right,
directly.
Right, it would get too dry and might burn
right,
it.
It might burn that.
Yeah, so you kind of want the water to go all around it. And it's fairly fail-proof.
I haven't done this, but I've had other needs for a pan inside a pan.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have a rack really to fit, but a couple of a canning rings work okay down there.
That's true.
Or any kind of thing that will raise it up.
I think one year I took kind of aluminum foil and formed a ring to set it on or something. You know, you can kind of be inventive with this.
Mm-hmm.
The main thing is you need kind of a large soup pan to be able to put the bundt pan or the mold inside of it. So then you cook it for a long time.
How do you tell when it's done?
I'm afraid you have to guess.
Right.
You know, as long as there's water in there. I think I had to add water one bit. You don't want it to run out of water. It'll just kind of keep cooking, and because you want to serve it warm. It's like a steamy thing. So you just take it out and you plop it out of its mold. And then I poured brandy on it, and we took it to the table and lit it. It was pretty wild, I have to say. I must have used – well, you heat the brandy so it's close to the flame point. Not too hot, but warm. And then you pour it over, and then you just use a match and you light it. And I'd put so much brandy, it like leapt onto the table, and we were all shrieking. But, you know, it burns at such a low temperature that it didn't even scorch the tablecloth.
Oh,
it's really funny.
Well, Donna, you really know how to throw a party,
I must say. We had a fun time with that. And then I served it with a hard sauce, mostly because the cake itself it's rather like fruit cake in that density, but it's also not terribly sweet. I did use plums that I had roasted and frozen instead of dried fruit. Well, I did put raisins in it, too, but I happened to have some local plums picked from my friend Carolyn and Fred's house. And so we put that into the fruitcake, and it was really delicious.
Oh, hence plum pudding.
Plum pudding. There you go. So hard sauce is, let's see. I did a little cream, a little butter, a little rum, some lemon juice, some vanilla, some sugar, and then you thicken it with cornstarch, basically. So it's kind of a light blonde, sweeter sauce with a little tang to it, and that you just pour over each piece, and it's yummy.
Oh, plum pudding. It's
That's
good.
The real thing there.
Yeah, you can do that. I like the setting it on fire part. That sounds
good. We did enjoy that, I must say.
We're going to go back to the polkestra band here and hear a little bit of the clarinet polka. Thank you. KHOI, Community Radio, Heart of Iowa Radio. For all of those nice folks in the Central Iowa District of Listening, I hope you all had a dandy Christmas, and we're exploring the 12 days of Christmas. There's all kinds of traditions and celebrations that you can look up the old ones and celebrate that, or come up with some new ones. Support this station. You can listen to Donalana Kitchen Tuesdays at noon, and we are again repeated 7 o'clock in the evening. You can also go to khoifm.org. We're streaming live, and also there's an archive there, and you can listen to past shows, or you can go to the Donalana Kitchen webpage and also listen to our past shows and see a great picture of Donna and I. We're on there someplace. Let's see. We have more days of Christmas to talk about. I always was familiar with the days of Christmas with that terribly pushy young suitor and giving the days of Christmas to his loved one and ending up with a whole mess of partridges in a pear tree and cows and geese. And it seemed a bit overdone, but I was aware that there was lots of celebrating going on. So what other things go on between Christmas
that's
and New
true.
Year's?
That song is the main thing that helps us remember the 12 days of Christmas. So let's see. We did day 9, which was the Evergreen Day. So day 10, now which day would that be? Let's see. New Year's
three
Day.
Three days
so this
afternoon.
Would be the 3rd of January. Okay. The 3rd of January is St. Distaff's Day, D-I-S-T-A-F-F, and the distaff is carried by the three fates of Greek mythology and has long been the symbolic icon of female power.
Right. The distaff has to do with spinning.
This is different from the staff. This is the distaff.
Yeah, distaff. It is. It has something to do with spinning and getting – it's women's work kind of thing. So it is a powerful symbol for females. Yes, it is.
Well, and apparently this is the day for – this is the back-to-work day is what it says. So day 11, which would be the 4th – no, that must be the 5th, don't you think? Are we day off? Okay, well, day 11. Well, the 6th is always day 12. So, the 11th has to be – so this is the eve of the Epiphany.
Oh, there
we go. Which is the Festival of the Three Kings. Now, our next show will be on Epiphany, so we will save that day and tell you what to do on that day. But this one, it says, is a day of giving of the gift. It says, blessings on giving a gift. Now, we've already had a lot of gifts, so this will have to be something special or maybe a gift to yourself. That would be about time, right?
Oh, I like that. I like
that. Think of all the things that you really – it does say listen to your own needs. So blessing on giving a gift. This is Caitlin Matthews, a Celtic devotional. Take and welcome joy within you. Showers, flowers, powers. Hatfuls, capfuls, lapfuls. Treasures, measures, pleasures. All be yours to enjoy. And then there will be the 12th day, and we will tell you all about that next week.
Oh, yes. I like that idea of giving oneself a gift. Good idea. Well, my gift actually that I gave to myself kind of goes in with the New Year's Eve, day 5. We got ourselves a new household vacuum cleaner. So we are
a woman's best friend, I must say.
Yeah, it's one of the women's empowerment sort of thing. Actually, I hate doing floors, so I let Joe do that.
Runs a vacuum cleaner.
Oh, he's big on floors.
Oh, bless you, Joe.
Yeah. So anyway,
good.
We're into clean this year. We're going to clean up all that dog hair and cat hair and be prepared for all the new spirits coming into our life. Oh. I have a question. There are flavors of the season here, and I run across them every now and then. I've tasted both and wonder what their history is. The history of mincemeat and juniper berries. Interesting flavors.
Well, mincemeat is English, old traditional, probably about like plum pudding, similar in a lot of ways, and that it does traditionally use beef suet and also some ground beef, which is why it's called mince meat.
There is mint.
And
mint
the only meat. Time I have ever made it, you know, aside, you know, usually you can, of course, buy it in the can or you can buy it. I think Fairway always sells it. It's very sweet, the one at Fairway. So it's it's a fermented thing traditionally, not the one at the fairway, but the one you really make. You have to start it kind of early in December and let the flavors, you know, lots of raisins, currants, apples, spices, then the actual meat and the actual beef. You know, obviously you need to have a recipe for this and know what you're doing, but that really is what mincemeat is, and it's called mincemeat because it's really dried fruits and meat and beef fat.
Well, if in days gone by, that was probably a real treat, meat and sweet in the middle of the coldest winters. What a good idea.
Yeah.
What a good idea. And what about juniper berries?
Well,
I found across that in
some recipes. Juniper berries, talking about the evergreens, and the juniper berries are actually not really berries. They are small cones and from the juniper tree. And there are lots of different kinds of junipers. I have a couple in my yard that are actually edible.
Huh.
And there, it does look like a little berry. It's a little kind of dark, dark, purpley thing. And I can pick them from my own tree, but, you know, usually buy them. The flavor is, it's a little piney, but it also ends with a sweet note. And mostly, it's used to cook meats.
Mm.
Pork is good. I actually did a pulled beef this year, which I put a lot of juniper in, along with garlic and onions and that sort of thing. And it's also it's the main flavor in gin. And gin, Dutch gin, used to be called Genever, which is the Dutch word for juniper.
Oh, so that's where that comes
from. Yeah, it's that kind of clean flavor that you get. It's also medicinal, diuretic, kind of used as a digestive. They're yummy.
Juniper berries.
Yeah.
So we celebrate the evergreen day and the pine trees and the conifers and the junipers and
it's,
all
it's
that.
It's definitely a kind of wintry flavor, I think.
Oh, good, good. Well, it's time to say goodbye to the old year and reflect on the new year. Take time to remember those that pass on. This time of year, a lot of people are going to go through and give a nod to those that have left us. And actually, I sort of am going to miss the Car Talk guys because one of the Car Talk guys on NPR passed away this year. Another excellent duo on the radio. They always made me laugh. And I want to share with you something that was passed along by a KHOI volunteer here, Ron Gardner. He sent this to me in my email. And here's the sad news of the passing of the Pillsbury Doughboy by Ron Gardner. The Pillsbury Doughboy died yesterday of a yeast infection and trauma, complications caused by repeated pokes in the belly. He was 71 years old. The Doughboy was buried in a lightly greased 4x9 pan. A bunch of celebrities turned out for his funeral. Mrs. Butterworth, Hungry Jack, California Raisins, Betty Crocker, the Hostess Twinkies, and Clon Dykebar. Aunt Jemima delivered the eulogy and described the Doughboy as a man who never knew how much he was needed. The funeral was held at 3:50 for about 20 minutes. The deceased was carefully removed and allowed to cool before serving. The gravesite was piled high with flowers. That's F-L-O-U-R-S, flowers. All right. The Doughboy was quick to rise in the show business, but his later life was filled with turnovers. He was not a very smart cookie. He wasted much of his life on half-baked schemes. He was flaky at times, especially in his heated moments, but he will be remembered as a sympathetic role model for many. The Doughboy is survived by his wife, Play Dough, two children, John and Jane Dough, and he's also survived by a granddaughter, Pastry Dough, grandson, Cookie Dough, and his uncle, Folded In, relationship there called Uncle Pop-Tart. The Doughboy will be missed by many of his fondue acquaintances. You have been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen with Lana Noctigal.
And Donna Prisgintas.
Excellent engineering by Rick Morrison. Celebrate the season with gusto and bubble in moderation. We'll go out with another polka.
Happy New Year!
Yes. Eat good food and enjoy life. This polka is a Celtic polka that actually features a didgeridoo by the Polkestra Band.